Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, you're listening to Wish We Knew What to Say with me, Pragya Agarwal. How do you talk to your child about discrimination, privilege, power, race, and racism? This is a podcast about talking with children about race. Covering all ages from toddler to teen, in each episode, I meet with a parent, carer, or educator to hear their experiences of having these vital conversations. Welcome to Wish We Knew What to Say, and today I'm really delighted to welcome Kotia Newland here. As you might have watched the recent series, Small Acts, which Kotia has written for Steve McQueen, the BBC series, which has really inspired a lot of dialogue and conversation around Black British identity and the opportunities, barriers, and challenges related to that. Of this series, Lover's Rock was jury selected for Cannes, and it opens New York Film Fest 2020. Kotia has published 7 works of fiction, including his debut, The Scholar, and I'm really excited to read his forthcoming novel, A River Called Time, and a collection of speculative fiction stories, Cosmogramma, which will be published by Canongate in 2021. Kotia's short stories have appeared in many anthologies, broadcast on BBC Radio 4, and included in Best of British Short Stories 2017. He has been awarded the Taner Barbers Award for Science Fiction Writing and the Ronald Rees Bursary for Playwriting. He was previously Associate Lecturer in Creative Writing at the University of Westminster and is currently completing a PhD in Creative Writing. Welcome, Kotia. I'm so delighted to have you here.
Hi, I'm really, really happy to be here. Thank you.
So I was just reading your background, something about background and heritage that you shared with us. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about it, because it's really interesting.
So, personally, I was born in Hammersmith. I was born in West London. I won't say what year, but my parents were Caribbean. My mum is from Black Rock, Barbados, which is in Christchurch, Barbados. Really, really lovely parish. My dad is from Kingston, Jamaica, which everybody knows. I mean, really vibrant, amazing place to have come from, I think. I'm really proud that my dad's from Kingston. I mean, anywhere in Jamaica would be cool, but you know, Kingston's got such a legacy. And my mum came to this country when she was 9. She was brought over. My grandfather and my grandmother were already in the country, and also my uncles, her older brothers, were in the country, and she came over with her younger brother when she was 9 years old, and she moved to Harlesden. And she lived in Harlesden, I think, until she reached adulthood. And my dad came over with my grandfather when he was 12. And he lived in Harlesden too. He left behind, I think, 2 brothers and a sister in Jamaica. I'm never really sure. And I think he had about 5 sisters, and his mother were in New York. So my Caribbean heritage is Jamaican Chinese. I've supposedly have got some Indian in there. People are never sure whether my great grandmother was part Indian or mixed race. And there's some Scottish in there that we've managed to trace back. My mum was doing some heritage, and yeah, apparently there was a Scottish man that in the very beginning, in the early days of the Caribbean, that can be traced. So that's my personal history, and then my family is just huge on both sides. There's so many different people. I couldn't even begin to go into that.
Thank you for sharing that. That's really fascinating. And I was actually talking to somebody earlier today about how we're all kind of citizens of nowhere and everywhere now. All these mixed, and we talk about mixed heritage now and so much and biracial, but it seems like all of us have all these kind of different origins and ethnicities and backgrounds all mixed together and mashed together in forming our identities. So how do you see yourself? I'm really intrigued by how people form their own sense of identity.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty settled on being, African British, Black British, whichever way you want to term it. Yeah, I'm from here. I was born in Hammersmith, West London, if you ask me. And that's where I'm from. I'm a West Londoner more than anything else. But obviously, my DNA and my heritage is Caribbean, and then my DNA and heritage is also African. But there's always been, my brother growing up, he was into martial arts, and he really loved Bruce Lee. And Bruce Lee famously said, you have to have some Chinese heritage in your blood in order to be a true martial artist. And he was always happy that we had Chinese cousins. He's like, okay, I count. So I've always felt an affinity for Chinese culture in a strange way, even before I really knew. I don't remember really knowing. But then I kind of said to my mum at one point in time, Mum, is it like, we have got Chinese in the family, right? Because I can remember meeting my cousins and they were Chinese when I was really young, and she was like, yeah, you do. But that was on my dad's side, so yeah, you just you get used to that. It all makes up who we are. And also, if you've got a kind of colonial heritage, or as particularly, I can't really speak for the rest of the world, but particularly in the Caribbean, Jamaica's national slogan is out of many one people, so it's part of who we are, we just have to accept it,
Yeah, it's really it's really interesting about the, especially the Bruce Lee incident.
my brother was so happy.
Some of the guests that I've been speaking to on this podcast as well, especially they're kind of second generation immigrants whose parents came here to this country as young people or even as adults, they've talked about how while they were growing up, in some way they kind of rejected that sense of their background and heritage because they wanted to fit in here and they were rejecting their culture and heritage.
Yeah.
How was your childhood and upbringing, and kind of while you were growing up, did you feel a really strong affinity with your Jamaican and Caribbean background? And how did you align that with everything else that was going on around you?
To be honest, I mean, I think my childhood was split into two phases. So I was born in Hammersmith, West London, but when I was about three, my mum and dad moved to Uxbridge, which is in Sussex, I think. It's kind of on the outskirts of London. And in those times, you're talking about, this would have been 1976. It was very, very... very white. I mean, I don't know how it is now, but it was very white and it was extremely racist. So at that point in time, I think I did struggle a little bit with my heritage. Like, I knew what the right thing was, which the right thing was to be proud of my heritage, and my natural thing was to be proud of my heritage. So, I remember being in school and in nursery school, I would have been about, 4 years old if I was in nursery school or reception class at least. And I was drawing a picture of my mum and I was using brown crayons, and the teacher got really angry with me and snatched the crayons out of my hand, started shouting at me and saying to me, you must draw her pink. And we had this big slanging match and I refused to draw my mum pink. And I was crying and everything. And then my mum came down to school. She had a real go at the teachers. And it was just like... my early childhood was like filled with trauma because of race, basically. So before I even knew what was going on, there was these big arguments and I was being pushed into a certain position and I resisted that position. So, I mean, it was really bad. People would fight my mum in the street. People would fight my mum outside the school gates when she came to pick me up. You know, it was really, really virulent racism. And you get called all sorts of words, sometimes by your friends, sometimes by people passing in cars, sometimes it was written on the wall. So everything we were talking about in small acts in the beginning, I lived that. It was really bad. And I was a kid and I was just like, I felt like I was in some kind of hell, you know, because it was just constant. It was all the time I had to be thinking about race. So I resisted, and I was constantly fighting myself, and I was constantly telling people not to say things about me or make jokes about me, and all this stuff was going on. But I did love like my culture, my food, my music, things like that, and I was very proud of it at the same time. But I think it's hard in a way, like you just absorb certain things without actually realizing you're absorbing them. And I really remember one time jumping up on my bed with my sweater or my jumper on my head so that I could have long hair. So I put my head in the thing and I was like playing about, like jumping up with my brother and be like, oh, look, we got long hair. And now when I look back at that, I'm just like, oh my God, that's just so bad. You know, but that's what I did. I did. I remember I didn't think about it. So as much as I resisted, something seeped in. And then, you know, my mum and my dad didn't stay together. And my dad, moved out. He actually went to live with my maternal grandmother, which is a whole story, you know, but she put him up in those first early days. And my mum was in Uxbridge on her own. And I think she just decided there's no way. And she looked at me and my brother and she was just like, well, you know, what's going to happen to him if we stay? And so she moved me back to West London. So about 7 or 8, I went back to West London, back in my culture, back in my environment. And started to feel opposite.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty shocking, isn't it, to hear these stories? I mean, you know that these things happen or happened or still happen. But it's always... When I listen to them and when I listen to a personal experience or story like this, it's really shocking. It just brings into focus how much a child's sense of identity is formed by where they're growing up and who they see around them. Exactly. And how people react towards them. And and some of them, as you say, can be internalized sometimes because a child is constantly grappling with external pressures as well about how people perceive them. And so it's so tough.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, I definitely just wanted to fit in, you know. I wanted to be called Tony, you know. I did not want to be called Courtier. I just wanted to fit in. I just wanted people to stop talking about this stuff, you know. But at the same time, I was very much like, you know, how dare you say all this stuff about me, you know. So it was a mixture of things. And I would always get into situations with other kids and things where, you know, kids would do things or say things and I'd be really, really angry with them. And I just think I spent most of my time being angry. And that's one thing I remember is that I fought so hard against it and I got told off for not fighting harder and, you know, all this stuff. So it was a really interesting time. Of course, I had a kind of situation much like Alex Wheatle when I was brought back into the community where I was just like, what's going on? And I didn't fit in, you know, I didn't fit in for a long time. But I, like Alex Wheatle, I tried my hardest to fit in, and eventually, you know, I got, and like Alex Wheatle, people came and took me under their wing and said, all right, listen, man, I'm just going to look after you. And some of them I'm friends with to this day. And yeah, it just, I had a sense of community. Even though I was slightly different right from the beginning, I was embraced and I was accepted, and I began to see blackness as something that I should love and that loved me. And then so I had a really, it changed everything for me. I think I don't know what would have happened if I'd have stayed in Uxbridge. I really don't. But I'm really grateful to my mum that she moved me out. And because of all the whole inner city stuff, my mum was always a bit like, I don't even know if I did the right thing. And I said to her one day, you know, you did the right thing, you know, Mum. And she was like, did I? And I was like, yeah, you did. So she's still wrestling with that to this day, yeah.
Yeah, I think as a parent, you always feel guilty. You're always wondering whether you're doing the right thing, I suppose. Yeah. But I think moving at that age seems like a good age, perhaps. Because if it was later, then maybe it could have a larger impact on you. And I was going to ask you about how did you find moving to West London? How did you still grapple with that whole notion of fitting in? Because it must have been such a huge change for you.
It was a massive change. It's really funny. There was a guy that lived on my road, and he was Indian, and I was like, you used to live in Uxbridge. He lived on the same road. He used to go to my same school in Uxbridge. I remember, and he moved like years before. And then I get on this road and he was going to the same school as me again. And I was like, you used to live in Uxbridge. And he denied it. No. I remember you. I remember your name. I remember things you used to do. It was you. You were in Uxbridge. So it was very much like that. Okay, that never happened, you know, like even with this Indian guy. And, it was difficult in some ways, and it was hard fitting in, but mostly it was okay. Mostly because everyone was just getting on with it, and everyone was used to seeing someone, all different types of black bits around. It's kind of like I got accepted in a way that I was never really accepted in Uxbridge. And it just continued. And as I got more into how things are in this side of London, it got better, you know. And then I became like a real West Londoner. I've been born there, but you know, I defend it to the hilt now.
Yeah, and I think it must change a child's kind of sense of identity or personal identity when you are the only person in a whole mass of like a crowd of people who don't look like you, and then you suddenly move on somewhere where more people are like you, and then you feel like, oh, I belong here. I think that notion of belonging is so crucial.
Really crucial. And it helped set my sense of who I was, but where I belonged. And it gave me kind of a foundation, you know, because not only was I from here, but my mother was from here and my dad was from here and my grandfather was from here. So I used to walk the streets of Ladbroke Grove with my grandfather, and he knew more people in Ladbroke Grove than me. People would be coming out of shirts saying, hey, long life. That's what they used to call him, long life. And like, I'd be like, what? Hold on, what's going on? And then I realised that my dad had been there since Sam Selvon days. You know what I mean? I'm sorry, my granddad had been in Ladbroke Grove since Sam Selvon days, and he could tell me all the old stories of West London. And so, and the roads he used to live on, and he remembered people who were the mothers of people I hung around with in West London and all this, and people would recognize me down the street. They say, hey, you're so-and-so's son, aren't you? I used to go raving with her. I used to go blues dances with her back. Yeah, but I was like, wow, this is mad. So that sense of like, okay, this is my place, right? This is my space. This is, this belongs to me. This is part of my heritage, not just my immediate heritage, but even before me, that just did so much for me. Yeah,
I think the sense of continuity is so important when you look back and you think, mm-hmm. this is history, this is legacy, and I'm connected through generations. And I think as a first generation immigrant, sometimes I think I find that maybe that is the challenge, because when we move to a new place or new country and you're trying to make home, you don't see that notion of continuity behind you in that place, and your children don't see that immediate sense of continuity, and that can definitely be a challenge, I think.
Yeah, it's a really big challenge. It's a huge challenge. But I think I was lucky in that respect, you know. And then, you know, it just, once you're in that space, it's something about, I don't know if it's specific to West London, if once you got to know a few people, and say you went to primary school in the area, then people from primary school knew people in your secondary school. And then people in your secondary school then would have parents who also knew my parents. So, and then, so you very, very quickly build up this real network of everybody who knows each other through everybody else. And next thing you know, you've got like a really massive unit, and you've got a neighborhood of people who all interact with each other and all remember different things about your heritage or your parents or your grandparents or my uncle who lived in Ladbroke Grove, so you would just have this kind of protective unit. And yeah, my friends in South London, they were kind of shocked. I took them, we were doing a project, they're writers, and we were doing a project set in West London. I said, let me just take you around West London. And we walked around West London, and they were just really baffled by how many people knew each other, not just in your immediate street, because I didn't even really live in Ladbroke Grove when I was growing up. I didn't live in Ladbroke Grove until I was like an adult. But going into Labour Grove, there's all these people that I'd grown up with that I knew. And it's just like, it's like hundreds of people. And I've not seen, I know that people do have it in other places, but I'd not seen it to that degree. And people seem always shocked when they come home, as I call it, and see that we've got that. And like I said, I just feel that, my wife was brought up in Gants Hill, and she had a similar experience to my experience in Uxbridge. But she never moved out, so she was there the whole time. And she says to me that it's always really interesting, the effect that having grown up in a really solid community had on me and my upbringing, my sense of self. You know, she says you can really see that I have a very strong sense of self because of that foundation of all the people around me and the culture and all of these things that are ours, you know, that belonging that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I think you growing up in Uxbridge, you talk about anger as well. And yeah. I think we talk about how there are stereotypes of black boys being more aggressive and I think that we don't talk enough about the kind of anger or the trauma that comes from having to face these kind of barriers or racism or racial prejudice and how that relates to their mental health, but physical health, but also how they interact with the world then, because they're always carrying this notion of I have to be tough to fight everything that's going on around me. Yeah. And I wonder, did all that was going on around you, did you have explicit conversations about racism with your mother? Or did she talk, or at school, anything like that? What's this happening with children at that time?
I mean, not in as much as the school was leading those conversations. The school was kind of oblivious to it. And you know, when I watched Education, that was pretty much how school was for me growing up as well, you know, like the way the teachers were, the way they would talk to you, with notable exceptions. I had an English teacher who was very aware of race. I think she'd just come out of teaching school, so she was very fresh and young. And we were her first ever class. And when we left in fifth year, she left too. She was like, that's it, I'm done. And but she was very, she would give us like lots of black books at a time where I don't think that was really happening. I'm not sure if she did it off her own back or it was kind of an ILEA directive. In a London Education Authority directive that if you had a certain amount of black kids in your school, your class, you had to give them some books. But I mean, some of the books she was giving us, it didn't seem like anything was on any curriculum, you know. She's giving us Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye and Chester Himes, like, you know, Cotton Comes to Harlem and stuff like that. I remember reading both of those books in school. And it was just amazing. It was like that was a real eye-opener. And then other teachers seemed to be more liberal in their leaning and be like, okay, so we're going to kind of try and take you under our wing. But then other teachers seemed a bit like they were kind of like undercover racist. I never forget, in one class, I had a history teacher. She was really nice. Everyone really liked her, but we could kind of walk all over her. She was quiet. She wasn't very strong. And she was doing a class about Christopher Columbus. And we were majority black class. And everyone's like, I don't want to hear about Christopher Columbus. He's a murderer. I mean, and like the whole class just rebelled against it. And the teacher going, I know, but that's what they tell me to teach. I mean, that's what it was like in the 80s, you know. She was really upset. She was like, I know I shouldn't be telling you guys this stuff, but like, what can I do, you know? So that was kind of very, very strange. But amongst ourselves, obviously, if we're saying that, we'd all been taught by our parents and you know, we were going to Saturday schools, like it says in Education, and we were going to the black bookstores, like Grassroots in Labour Grove, and we were getting an education outside of our education. My grandfather would tell me all sorts of stuff, tell me about Paul Bogle in Jamaica and Marcus Garvey and all this stuff. And so, yeah, we were very, very aware, and we'd been very shored up by all of this stuff that we were being told.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting about Christopher Columbus, because I remember learning about it at school growing up in India. And I don't think we ever, even had the awareness to question the narrative that we were taught. And now I look back and I think, what were we taught and what we believed in at that point? It's really interesting about the whole, how the notion of colonialism is turned, flipped on its head, the narrative, and it is seen as this kind of, he founded something or discovered something or he saved people from doom. So I think it's really fascinating to hear that at least that kind of consciousness and that awareness was there already at that time, even without the curriculum.
Yeah. My mum had been in the Black Panthers when she was quite young. And also, my grandfather used to say stuff to me like, you know, how could Christopher Columbus have discovered somewhere where people already existed? we were constantly being told that what we were being taught was wrong. And even not just by, my mom and my grandfather. I remember one of my teachers, he was my design and technology teacher. And in second year, he said, listen, put down that stuff. Let me tell you about something that you should have been taught. I'm going to tell you about thalidomide. And he told me about the story. He told the whole class the story of thalidomide. And that was our lesson for the day. Right, so even certain of our teachers were anti-establishment. So and then afterwards he's like, don't tell anyone this happened. So it was a wild education.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
You talk and write a lot about, obviously, Black British identity, and you talk about how you are very secure and growing up later, but also, of course, now identify as a Black British man. And you've talked a little bit about before, and I've read some of your interviews about how Black British identity is different to American British identity, American Black identity. And I wondered if you would elaborate on that a little bit. Quite intrigued by that.
Well, I mean, just, you know, our starting points are slightly different, aren't they? I mean, there's the fact that I have a separate, I have a heritage that is separate to my Black Britishness. You get what I'm saying? In a way that, like, African American, in a way that ism or being African American culture is steeped in America. And then maybe if you can go back with some Africa, and obviously that's different for African Americans who are from the Caribbean, you know, they have something similar to me. But the majority of people, generations and generations have been in America, and that's it. So that first thing that my heritage goes back to the Caribbean, or other people's heritage goes back to Africa, whether that's Nigeria or Ghana or South Africa or wherever they on the continent they come from, that's slightly different. That does something, you know. I have a separate heritage to the place in which I was born. You know, that that's That's the first thing. But also what that brings as well is the fact that they have a legacy of slavery occurring on the land that they were born on. And we don't. You know, slavery largely wasn't occurring in this country even when it was legal. You know, it was to a degree, but not, there were no plantations here. You know, they were back in the country where we were born, you know. So that's slightly different as well. You know, there's a kind of a disassociated trauma, I think, because of that. Because, I mean, we face all sorts of emblems of the slave trade here. And don't even know it sometimes, you know, because there were things here, you know. There were there's all the statues that everyone's been talking about lately, you know. There's been a legacy of statues that we've been talking about for years, you know. There's buildings that have been erected and things, plaques and all this stuff, you know, which is basically, you know, the legacy of slavery. But the actual plantations and blood in the soil isn't here in the same way. And just to put that in context, you know, there were auctions, you know, like I heard there were auctions on Tottenham Court Road and on Oxford Street, you know, of slaves. So it's not that, in that sense, yeah, things were happening here in that sense, but yeah, the actual, you know, crops being grown and people being bred, that kind of stuff didn't happen here. So that's slightly different.
Yeah, I think the background, the heritage, I think, is different. Which, as you say, it the kind of trauma is associated or dissociated or direct, that makes a difference. But also, it kind of demonstrates how dangerous it is sometimes to homogenize the whole group and identity into one label. Say, no. Black people everywhere, or I mean, even worse when you say BME or anything that. That's even worse. Without actually thinking of the context of where we come from or where people come from and the kind of heritage and legacy that is specific to a particular place, that makes a difference to what is happening today and how they see themselves today, and I suppose.
Totally, yeah. And the same goes for being African British. You know, and the differences between that and being, you know, Caribbean British. You know, there's some nuances and differences there as well. I also think that that there's one other thing that I didn't mention, which is the fact that we haven't been in this country as long. Like being you know, African British or Black British is a very new thing in comparison to being African American. Which, like I said, has got generations and generations of that. So sometimes I used to say growing up, you know, we've actually come really, really far in a very, very short space of time in comparison, you know. Like, so when people say, oh, we don't have this and we don't have that, you know, in numbers, of course, we've been here since Roman times and probably even before that. You know, we know this. If you look in the history books, it's there. But in numbers, we haven't existed in this way ever before. We're a very, very new phenomena. And so like a lot of the things that the strides that we've made have been made relatively quickly, if you think about it. You know our civil rights movement has moved very, very fast, and we're still, you know, behind in so many things. But I sometimes think that we're too hard on ourselves, considering, you know, when my grandmother came over.
I think that notion of the strides that have been made in representation is changing. I think has changed quite a lot in the last year. And one of the things, of course, is recently the series Small Acts that has really brought on this conversation a lot. How was that writing for you? And how did you find writing about some of these topics, which might have personal resonance, of course?
It was very emotional. Of course, you know, in different ways. You know, I wrote two. I wrote and I co-wrote them with Steve, of course. But I wrote two. I co-wrote Lovers Rock, and I co-wrote Red, White, and Blue, and they were emotional in completely different ways. Obviously, you know, Lovers Rock was euphoric, and it was full of joy and beauty and passion and lust and, you know, all of these things that are human traits and human emotions. And we got a chance to explore that in a really deep and detailed way. And, you know, Red, White and Blue was about, you know, obviously a man who's trying to change an institution from the inside, and also a man who has a kind of a turbulent relationship with his father for all sorts of reasons, and managing to find his way through both of those things simultaneously, you know, come to terms with that, or come to a peace with that in different ways. A lot of the stuff in Red, White and Blue particularly was really, it brought back a lot of the stuff that I was telling you about growing up in Uxbridge and being in West London, even in the 80s, you know, and some of the stuff that was going on. And I could really draw from that reality, you know. But mostly, I have to say, it was really fun. Even writing about the stuff that was traumatic for me was kind of cathartic, and getting it out and realizing that, wow, all this stuff, and this was the culture, and this is what we had. And wasn't it a beautiful thing? Even if it was a struggle, it was a beautiful struggle.
I think the sense of pride really shows mm-hmm. through as well. I've been wondering about representation quite a lot, and about how much we need to see ourselves, especially our children need to see ourselves on screens. Mm-hmm. And I think since Black Lives Matter, things have changed or shifted a little bit in terms of what we are seeing and how much visibility there is, although there was always this concern that it could be like a momentary thing, and that once the momentum is over, then we don't know if things will really shift or change. Have you really seen a change since Black Lives Matter, or things are changing?
There's definitely been a change. And I think that change has mostly been in people's viewpoints, which I find really strange, because this is not the first time this stuff has happened. I mean, this stuff has been happening. I mean, what did people think the 2011 riots was about? Like, what did you think that? You really thought it was about trainers? You really thought it was about kids wanting consumer objects? You really didn't tie that up to what happened to Mark Duggan, like, and how unjust that was? Like, I don't understand. So I find it a bit strange, to be honest, to think about this in terms of, oh, Black Lives Matter has changed the conversation. In terms of the arts that we've been creating, you know, go back to my first novel, and my first novel opens with an act of police brutality. This was in 1997. My last play concerns an act of police brutality, and I wrote that in 2014. Sitting in Limbo and I May Destroy You and Small Acts were all in production before this moment happened. And so what that says to me is that the moment is circular. We're talking about the same things, and the same things haven't been rectified or changed. And so it seems relevant when it happens, because it seems like, oh, this is the perfect moment. And they're talking about something that has finally changed things. Now, in terms of Black Lives Matter, they've changed things, but basically it's been like a huge tidal wave which has been pushing at this wall. And eventually, I think more to do with the pandemic, actually, I don't know if it broke yet. I think at least it cracked a little bit, you know, and it remains to be seen whether those cracks will be cemented up again, or whether the whole thing will just collapse and the floodgates will be open, because I feel like we've been here before, especially in terms of the arts, you know, Black British arts. We've been here before. When I first came out in 1997, it was supposed to happen then. And then there was a pushback, and all that stuff was stopped, you know, and it was called political correctness gone mad. So, I think in terms of our arts, I'm really, really optimistic. But in terms of like changing minds in that sense, I'm quite cynical.
I would agree with you on that. When everything was happening, I was just sitting there thinking, this is not the first time that people have talked about it. Police brutality has been happening for a very long time. Initially, there was this reluctance to even accept that this happens here. People were talking when this happens somewhere else, like it's an American problem, it's a US problem, it's not something that's happening here. And some of these conversations have been happening in media again and again. Every time something happens, there's more people from people of color or BME community or Black or brown people are brought into media to talk about these things. Can you talk about your experience? Have you faced something like this? And it just feels like, as you say, it's a cycle that keeps on happening. And when media decides that it's trendy to talk about it, then we hear more about it. So yes, I was very cynical as well. I do think that the conversation is changing, but sometimes it's very performative just to fit the current trend. But what we're seeing more on television, perhaps, or in media or movies, that is certainly, there has been a distinct shift in the way to acknowledge that some of the racism or race, it can be in insidious ways, or it's so deeply ingrained that we can't just dismiss or ignore it. I think there has been that little shift.
Yeah, it's a tiny shift. And I actually believe that what the change, the true change, the big shift will be when we turn on the telly and we see not something like Smallax, but something that has that kind of power, something that has that kind of, becomes that water cooler moment, as they say in TV. And we don't actually have to acknowledge the fact that it's a novelty, that people of colour are on the screens. It's just a talking point because it's good drama. That's going to be the major change. I want to see that day. I hope I can see that day.
Yeah, I hope so too. And I think that's something that I always talk about books as well. When we talk about children's books, and people say we need to diversify their shelves, and they have to be exposed to different cultural backgrounds. And I always wonder, why can't just we have black and brown people just doing normal things in books, rather than having to make a point about that this is a book about black person or a brown child or something like that.
Yeah, the fact that you're making the point proves that we haven't done enough work, or enough work hasn't been done yet, you know? And the thing is about books, unlike film, because film is such a... it's about money, isn't it? It's about having a certain amount of money to do these things, and with that money comes a certain amount of privilege. Books has there's a certain amount of privilege too, but not as much, you know? But you know, the stuff's out there. There's so much... I've seen so many books out there that, you know, have people of colour in them, whether they're written by people of colour or not. Sometimes I think it's quite selective to go into the bookstore and see a whole load of books written by people who are not of colour, about people of colour, and the books that are written about people by people of colour are not in the bookstore. I can't find those books. And these are award-winning writers, and I've gone to look for this specific book. I can't find it in the bookstore, but I can find certain others. So that's another thing that would need to be rectified. But I think, you know, these people are writing these books. So it's about just like publicizing them more and getting them out there more and starting a discussion about what's already there, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So you have two children, Kotia, don't you? Mm. And how old are they?
I have a son who is 12, and I have a daughter who is 5.
And they're mixed heritage, so to speak, because your wife's got an Indian.
Yeah, my wife's got an Indian background, and yeah, I am who I am.
Yes. So how did your children react to Black Lives Matter? Did they find that kind of watershed moment, or that's something that has always been in your family that you've talked about?
All right. So the way that we have decided to raise my kids might be interesting to some people, I think. Because my wife went through this experience in Gants Hill, and because I went through this experience in Uxbridge, we decided to try and let them have their childhood. So we wanted to raise them in a manner where their race is normality and they are not othered. I didn't want to other them in my house. So as far as I was concerned, we do talk about aspects of racial heritage, racial history, but for especially when they were very, very, very young, I did not talk to them about racial discrimination. Instead, what I did was try and surround them with a racial foundation. So in our house, it would be normal to see, you know, books by writers of colour. It would be normal for me to read them. We've got posters. We've got, you know, like we've got pictures. We've got art. We've got sculptures. We've got like, and we surrounded them with those things. So they were very aware of where they come from. And I didn't talk about that stuff. And then as soon as they got to an age where I thought they might start to understand those things, and also they were, you know, the school's very good, and the school was talking about South Africa and apartheid with my son, and, you know, this and that, and, you know, and colonialism and slavery. And so then we had those conversations as well alongside that. And so they had a grounding in normality, in them, their, where they came from being normal and who they were being normal. We coupled that with going back to India quite regularly, you know, going to Africa quite regularly, going to the Caribbean quite regularly, and just making sure that they understood, you know, their place in the world a little bit better before we started having those conversations. So by the time Black Lives Matter came along and what happened to George Floyd, I could explain it in some kind of context, you know. That was the plan anyway.
No, I think it's a big embedded in their cultural heritage and identity, and understanding where you come from, I think it's so crucial for a child. And I think that seems really an absolutely perfect way to do it, because you are both quite secure in where you come from, and you're quite accepting and just completely comfortable with it. And so surrounding a child with that, them knowing about it, them traveling to those places and seeing other people like themselves and knowing that this is a part of who I am, just without any question or any kind of debate, I think is so, just so perfect.
Yeah, thank you. Sometimes, you know, I just wondered, you know, to be honest with you, it wasn't like cut and dried, like, oh, I've done the right thing, like I was saying to you earlier, you know. I was like, there were certain conversations that we were not having, we wouldn't even discuss for a long time, we wouldn't even talk about people being black or white, you know. We just refused to have that kind of conversation. And even now, I think my son, they both find it quite confusing. It's funny, my daughter is really, really more aware of skin color and things like that than my son was. And I think that's because a lot of this stuff is gendered as well, you know. Like when you look at the way that girls are dealt with in terms of their ideals of beauty and stuff, it's just like they can't help it. It's like osmosis. They get a lot of this stuff without dialogue, you know. It's from visual cues and stuff like that. So she's very, we're gonna have to work on that. We are working on that, you know, in terms of how she views herself and how she views her skin color in particular, you know. My son, we were able to avoid a lot of that talk and just avoid calling people white or black for quite a long time. And then until he had an understanding of what that meant politically. And even now we still have discussions about it, because he's like, you know, he said to me, it doesn't really make sense. Like, you know, that person's not white and that person's not black, you know. And white can be so many things and black can be so many things. And so we're having those kind of discussions about it, which is what I think a lot of adults even have, you know. And there's no hard and fast answers, but we keep trying to have a continuing dialogue with them both on it, you know, rather than being absolute.
Yeah, I think what you mentioned about girls having these external, really extra pressures on them because of the whole notion of beauty, as you say, is so idolized and rooted in the kind of these Western ideals, certain skin color, in certain body shapes, in certain way that girls mature and hair and everything like that. Those pressures are more certainly. And so it is very gendered. And I've noticed that with my own eldest daughter about how she struggled with that because she was predominantly in white spaces and her body matured at a different rate. And so brown and black women can be hypersexualized sometimes as well because of the way they mature. And so she never felt like she was beautiful, even though she got these messages so much at home all the time about bolstering her identity and esteem. Mm-hmm. So I think that is really hard to do that. And I think for that, perhaps representation and role models are very important because they need to see themselves and this whole range of beauty rather than one particular template that they are good.
We have a lot of books and magazines that we get for her. My mum's just been buying her some stuff. I think it's a magazine called Coco Girl. And she's got that and she's looking at that. And, you know, so we're just trying to, again, we try and be very subtle about it and just like make sure that these things are in place. But like you say, it's, even if you do all that stuff, you still got the outside world and what they see, you know, like the representative beauties are vastly different outside your door, you know. So, you know, there's that to combat with. And so, like I said, I don't necessarily feel like I've nailed it or anything. I think this is going to be an ongoing, you know, struggle, battle, whatever you want to call it, probably for the whole of their lives, you know, until they get to a place where they feel comfortable with it, you know.
Hey, yeah. Thank you, you know.
I hope so. But what you mentioned with boys or with your son especially, like such an interesting conversation about these labels that we assign people and boxes, like somebody's white or black or brown, but it's a whole spectrum. And it sometimes can be very confusing for a child if you to understand where they fit in and do we need to be in a box or do we need to have a label and how do I call myself? Am I a brown person or am I a black person or am I just both or, you know?
Yeah, especially because he's mixed heritage, you know, he's like, yeah, where do I fit in that? I mean, he's lucky enough to have a few people around him that are of the same heritage. And that's I'm certainly, you know, really glad for that. He's not like the only person. But it's still difficult because, you know, is he like me or is he like his mum or is he neither? And, you know, all of these things I see going on around in his head. And then, you know, there are certain people of African heritage that he looks just like. And there are certain people of Indian heritage he looks just like. And it's like, you know, it's just so, I can see how it can be slightly confusing and a bit easier for me and his mother in a sense, because we fit in a more stereotypical way.
Yeah, my children are also mixed heritage, so white and Indian. And I worry about that because they don't have any other role models. So from my husband's side, everybody is white. And from my side, everybody is brown and Indian. There's no mixed heritage children. So their cousins or anybody is not, nobody's mixed heritage. So I worry about that a little bit, about how they are going to shape their sense of, and they're also quite white passing, but with dark hair and dark eyes. So, So I think they will have certain notion of privilege because of being white passing, which is something I think I will have to have a conversation with at some point.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen some people have some really healthy, interesting conversations with their kids like that, and well, I've been actually impressed with the way that they view the fact that they're white passing. And I've seen it go the other way as well. I mean, my kids. I think I would say they definitely look of mixed heritage, but they actually look mixed heritage like white and black. If you had their voice, so it's really, they kind of look almost like the stereotype of a mixed heritage kid who's white and black. So that's really interesting. We were a bit like, oh, how did that happen? You know, because you know we're both quite dark. You know? I find comfort in the fact that for them, there's a lot of people who look like them around them, and in our family there is, you know, we've got like lots of mixed heritage adults and kids, you know, in our family. So yeah, they actually look like their cousins more than anything, you know, which is kind of cool. And also I remember being very aware of their schooling, like I, you know, because, I suppose because of what happened to me, you know, I was like, I am not bringing my kid up in a school where they are the only ones. They have to be around all different types of people. So I need them not just to be comfortable with people from our heritage, but people who are not as well. So, you know, if someone's Muslim or someone's, you know, like Slovakian or something, like, it needs to be normal. Because that's the upbringing I had when I came to West London. I was friends with all different people from all different parts of the world. And you want to be comfortable. Then to be comfortable with people from different parts of the world and comfortable with difference, you know? And so, yeah, we wanted to make sure they went to a school where that was integral to the way that they educated, but also to the actual makeup of the school itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is really, really important. And even though as I talk about my older daughter who went to a very white school, she went to a specialist music school, which had children from all over the world. So they never... she was exposed to different nationalities in a way, even mm-hmm. though and even though she was the only brown person there. Yeah. And I find that I think it's a challenge for us now because we live in the Northwest and we live in a small village where my children's growing up without a sense of the world being so multicultural and diverse. And we're having those conversations now at home about whether we should move and be somewhere, because I really don't want them to grow up in a place where they don't see the world how it is then go out and be fearful of people who look different, you know, because that
yeah happen. Or people who look like them. Like I was talking to Nikesh the other day and I'm saying I make a joke at home, I want my son to be able to, and my daughter, sorry, but it's just because my son was there first, but I want them to be able to go into a Caribbean restaurant and look at the menu and know what he's going to eat. You know, I want him to feel, and the same for an Indian restaurant. I want him to feel comfortable with all aspects of his makeup, you know, his heritage, to just be like, yeah, I know that and I know that, and see it as an asset rather than a deficit, you know, but also be comfortable in British culture as well, and feel proud of that, proud of the things that you should be proud of, and question the things that you should question in all of our cultures, not just like it's a wholesale, okay, you know, black good, white bad, you know what I mean? People, you know, they view things in this way, you know, they say, oh, wokeness and political correctness gone mad, that it's all, that's the binary. But it's about just being at home, but also critical with every aspect of your being.
And how to encourage our children to think critically. And what yep. you'd say about being comfortable, I think is really important for me. Like my four-year-old, when we first took them to India last year, they were a bit fearful. They hadn't seen so many brown people ever in one place. And it wasn't because they were biased or prejudiced. It was because they were unfamiliar to them. And they were very, very overwhelmed with it all. And and it really initially upset me because it's like, I don't want them to feel like this.
Yeah, sure.
But now if they ever want to listen to an Indian song or eat an Indian sweet, it makes me really happy because at least they're connecting with that part of their heritage.
Exactly. I just think, like I said, normalizing it is really, really key. And my wife's cousins, they're mixed heritage, Indian and German, and they're both really, really steeped in their Indian culture, and their mum made sure of that, so they can all cook Indian food. They all like feel very comfortable wearing saris. They've all traveled around India, you know, like, so as a family. And I just think it's so great to see, you know, that, like, and it just, wherever you come from in the world, I always expect people to be proud of where they come from. I don't care where you come from, you know what I mean? Whether and it's, again, like I said, the racist thing we're expecting British people not to be proud of where they come from. And that's not it. We expect them to question the things that don't work, but also be proud of so many things. There's so many good things that came out of British culture, and things that I'm proud of being a part of myself, you know. But the things that we shouldn't be proud of, we should talk about. We should say, okay, well, maybe we could do that better moving forward, you know. And like I said, it's the same for our cultures too, our cultures of heritage too. But to see someone who really feels at home and comfortable in themselves, you know, in lots of ways, but, you know, especially culture and heritage, is really, I don't know, I love it. I love it, you know. I love someone who can sit down and break down to me British history in a really, like, you know, like Ra Page from Comma Press or someone like that, who could just be like, okay, this is British history and this with that. And I'll just sit down and listen and be like, that's so fascinating, you know. How can you not be curious about the world in its entirety? I just don't know.
Me too. And I think we sometimes, as you say, fall back on these binary divisions rather than looking at the whole spectrum of things. And the whole British history, the whole multi-layered nature of it, that's an asset that we should really be proud of as well. I see mixedness not as a challenge sometimes. And I think it's such a good thing for children to have that as different parts of their identity be shaped by different cultures and heritage. That's true citizens of the world, I think.
But it's also been part of our natural evolution as a human race. You know, I mean, it's part of our success is that we've mixed and we've shared ideas and we've done all sorts of things together as a race, you know, and to it's been going on since time began. You know what I mean? We've been doing this. So it's really strange, this idea that everybody should settle in their, you know, distinct parts of the world and there was no mixing that happened before. Because when you really look at the history books, that's absolute rubbish. That wasn't going on. I remember going to Kenya and we went to Mombasa and we visited a museum and they had crockery and pots and bowls and stuff that had come from China. And it turns out that Kenya had been trading with China way before colonization, and they had all the, you know, these artifacts there to prove it, you know. You know, there's so many examples. It's just crazy. And I thinking of it from a position of abundance, you know, rather than lack and things that you need to defend is a much stronger position.
It's such a perfect place to stop. And I think I could speak with you all day. There's so much we could talk about, and it's been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
it's just amazing to have a chance to have a conversation with you and to hear your perspective on this. And thank you so much, Kotia. It's been lovely.
Thank you for listening to Wish We Knew What to Say with me, Dr. Pragya Agarwal. If you enjoyed this episode, you might also like the accompanying book, which gives scenarios, questions, thought starters, resources, and advice on how to tackle some of these tricky conversations around race and racism with children. Wish We Knew What to Say, the book, is available in hardback, ebook, and audiobook from all good bookshops and online retailers. That's all for this week's episode. Please subscribe for more. See you next time.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.